Welcome to the latest edition of Cover to Cover. And it's a pleasure to be your host, Eusebius McKaiser, in conversation with a couple of authors who've written books that I think really travel well across time and space and will endure for quite a while. So what's really nice about today's edition is that we focus quite a bit on books over the last couple of months that are, you know, books that are newly released for the most part. And even by the standards of longevity, the books that we'll cover today, one written by Andrew Harding and one by Mo Sheikh, both of them in a sense are still recent books. But we tend to be quite in the moment with our book journalism and talk about books that have been released in the last week. And these are books that have come out over the last 2 years or so. And having reread them in preparation for today's show, I can't believe that they aren't even more popular, even though both have been critically received. So you are in for a treat, and I hope that you will enjoy the show. So first up is Mo Sheikh. Mo wrote the book, The ANC Spy Bible. It is absolutely brilliant. It is lyrically written, even though the subject matter is incredibly difficult, about his experiences in the underground, in the fight against apartheid, a very personal memoir of his role, but one which also exposes some of the broader issues that was endured by his comrades and not just himself in the making of our nascent democracy. Mo, good morning to you, and thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me, Eusebius.
I mean, you know, rereading this book for the umpteenth time was really, really interesting because it just struck me how much this is a book that is going to be around for an awfully long time because of its critically important chronicling of your life and all of the issues about our country that comes out of it. With the benefit of time having passed, how do you feel about the book now, looking back on the journey of having written it and its initial landing that got a lot of attention?
Well, I'm pissed off with COVID because, you know, that the book was released on, I think, 7th of March when we did it. And then COVID was 27th, right? But despite that, the book did very well. I'm also rereading it now because I'm making it an audiobook. I am taken aback by some of the issues I've raised and how current they are in our country today. So yeah, I want to pick up some of those themes in a follow-up book, but I think there are many issues there that are very, very relevant today.
So I've interviewed Mo a couple of times and I was trying to think, how can I keep it interesting for you, but also for him, so that he's not rehearsing previous conversations we've had. So what we're going to do, Mo, is just to give snapshots of different themes and bits of reading so that those who haven't yet heard you speak about the book and get a sense of it, but you and I can also have some new conversation to keep us interested. There are two characters that you write about. Lieutenant Buerta is one of them, and of course the other one is Lieutenant Robert Shaw. Tell the viewers of this program who they are and how interestingly different they are.
Well, okay, let's deal with Henty Buerta first. So Henty Buerta is Afrikaans, has come through the ranks of the security branch. Interestingly, he's a Namibian, otherwise called Southwest African, who comes to South Africa. He's a great athlete. He was going to be chosen as an Olympian, but he couldn't participate in the Olympics because of the sanctions against South Africa. So very pissed off with, you know, all things that stopped his own progression. And I think he brings that hatred, so to speak, into his work. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, you have Lieutenant Robert Shaw, who is an English South African, who, and you know South Africa's history with the English, etc. In a very Afrikaner institution. So he has to, in many ways, please his bosses, but not lose the essence of who he is. And he turns out to be a very good interrogator, a very good investigator, but someone who could put distance between the war that we were fighting and victory and loss. So he knew at the end that he was losing the interrogation battle, but he didn't take it personally, Whereas on the other hand, Hentibwotha takes it very personally.
It's interesting to me because one of the many beautiful themes in your book is this relationship between the captor and the captive. Yes. And I wondered at one stage whether you suffered a little bit of Stockholm syndrome. You write on page 57 about Robert Shaw. Perhaps he was troubled by his own demons. The tension does things to both the captor and the captured. A strange bond develops. This bond does not lessen the contradiction that separates enemies. It rises above it. In the confines of the restricted battleground, vulnerabilities are shared. For instance, Robert Shaw was concerned about his sensitive young son. Why he confided in me, I shall never know, but I respected him for doing so. His son was an outsider in a macho culture, and he feared that the boy would not cope in a country that demanded much of its white males. I find it extraordinary, the level of humanity that you display and describe to him is not what many of us would expect under conditions of conflict.
Yubi, this goes to, in my opinion, the nature of revolutionaries. Often we see revolutionaries as people who adopt violence and adopt violent methods and therefore are by nature violent and by nature aggressive, etc. In my experience, it's been completely the opposite. I think almost all revolutionaries that I know are highly sensitive human beings. Today we have a term for it called HSPs, right? And highly sensitive human beings demonstrate an enormous amount of empathy. Why we suffered torture so badly? Because it offends our sense of what is human. But that humanity is not only for ourselves. So we can see the humanity in others even when they don't see it. And I think most detainees, and you see it best explained by Mandela, how Mandela developed very deep empathetic relationships even with the people who kept him for so many years, right? And I think that is the nature of just being human. And this is one of the most misunderstood things about revolutionaries. And recently I came across a quote by Che Guevara. And the quote is that one of the most endearing or the most important characteristics of a revolutionary is the compassion to love. And I think that is it. And this is why we party so hard, we have so much of fun, we can, you know, give our lives to what we have to do, because there's a deep, deep love for humanity. And I saw it in Robert Shaw.
Unsurprisingly, a big part of the book deals with torture and being in detention. And I want us to turn to page 59. Let me just see whether I can find that. It's really extraordinary. If it's too difficult to read, please stop. You and I are acquaintances, and I also know from previous conversation that although you've written this, when one reads it out, it re-inscribes the pain for many people who are watching. But start for me where it says, the effort to keep sane became harder. I keep going back to that passage. Yeah. Those of us who are too young to know experientially what torture and detention was about, for me, the passage starting there till the end, but we may not read all of it, and listen very carefully, gives you a deep sense of what folks like Mo went through for us to be free.
The effort to keep sane became harder. The vacuum fed the catatonic drift to self-withdrawal, amplifying the constant voice of despair that played over and over in my head. My thoughts spoke loudly and incessantly. I awoke each morning with renewed hope that today the horror would end. As the hours passed, positive thoughts gave way to negative ones, and then to hopelessness and utter frustration. Sometimes I screamed out my frustration to the silence of the corridors. Only the damned of the place could hear me.
It's okay, let's leave it there.
Yeah.
It's beautifully written, by the way. Could have been written by Sylvia Plath.
Yeah.
Except it's real and it's your experience.
Mm.
Do we still have in our midst, including in leadership in government, many comrades that have undiagnosed or unattended to post-traumatic stress syndrome?
Absolutely. I think there's an entire generation of people who, for the sake of democracy, did not attend to themselves. And that is the burden, in my view, and the unquietness of our own democracy, where we don't speak about these things.
Mm.
And I think you've seen it, and it is visible through many of the generations. However, there is one other thing that exists, Eusebius, which I think that we need to talk about at some point.
Mm.
That the trauma of apartheid has become intergenerational. Intergenerational in the sense of the social inequalities that exist, intergenerational in the stories that we tell the generation that comes after us. And I think in many ways it explains the violence that we see in our society, and it explains even to a great extent the gender violence that we see in our country. Because as a country, we have not yet grappled with the challenges of perpetrators, victims, and we still haven't embraced the forgiveness of survivors.
Absolutely.
And I think that's the challenge we have.
We're running out of time, and you and I can talk for a long time because your book allows that. In the last minute, let's give them another sense of another complicated theme that emerges.
Yeah.
You write about September.
Yes.
Who's captured Flakplaas.
Yes.
And turns on you.
Mm-hmm.
Becomes an Askari. Is the attitude towards Askaris for you a matter of black and white, or are there complexities about how you view those who were turned?
It's a very, very complex issue. And I've seen that not only in that period, but even in the period where I become the head of intelligence, where I'm dealing with sources. Why someone becomes a source? Why does someone work for the other side? And why does someone accepts all the brutality of the other side? For me, is a fascination. It has taken me to neuroscience. It has taken me to understand the human mind and the choices that people make.
Mm.
So no, it's not a black and white issue.
Okay.
And I do not attach good or bad. I attach complexity. And I'm fascinated by that complexity.
Mm.
And why is it that people do certain things? One of the issues that is easy to accept, and that is, it is fear. Well, you know, in management science, fear produces the most narcissistic behavior in leaders and in managements. We've seen it in our own country.
Mm.
The fear of losing power produces the worst kind of leadership. And I think the fear of me losing my life will force me to do things that otherwise are terrible.
Mo, you've written a stunning book, the ANC Spy Bible. It's still available, and rightly so, nationwide. Please find an edition of it. And on social media, you can follow me. When an audio book version is made available in his own voice, by the way, I will punt it as well. But I recommend this book. It's a book which, if you haven't read it, you really should. It is absolutely beautiful. Thank you, Mo.
Thank you. Thank you, Yumi.
I hope you enjoyed that interview with Mo Sheikh. What an absolutely fantastic guy and a great book. Absolutely great book. And please, I really meant that you must go and buy a copy. In this next segment of today's show, I'm interviewing someone who also wrote an absolutely amazing show. At some point, we're going to have to tell you what books are crap, because quite clearly, all the authors that we've been featuring are really good. But we mean it sincerely. And it's my pleasure to be interviewing author and broadcaster Andrew Harding, who works for the BBC. He's an excellent journalist, on radio and TV. But as excellent as he is, I reckon he's an even better writer. He wrote The Mayor of Mogadishu, which is brilliant. I recommend you go and buy it. And then he wrote the second book, which is as good as his first book was. And you can see I'm holding it right here. These Are Not Gentle People. Beautiful cover and a lovely title as well. Thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you. What an introduction. Very flattered.
It's well deserved. In 2016, in January, in Paris of all people, something happened. Tell us the story.
An elderly white farmer is attacked, it appears. He presses an alarm button in his isolated farmhouse, and his neighbors and relatives, the Van der Vesthazen clan, very powerful group of people in the fields and the commercial farms outside Paris, rush, thinking there's been a farm attack. They're told two, possibly three black men attacked old Ludi. Two men are chased across the fields and quickly caught, arrested by the farmers and their sons. And then over the course of several hours, they are beaten systematically by a number of those men. The police arrive, the two men are taken away, and both are pronounced dead the next morning. Those two black men turn out to have been farm workers, known to some of those people who actually assaulted them. And then there is eventually a trial, which frankly still hasn't finished today for something years later. There's not been sentencing. And this one moment of collective fury causes these extraordinary frictions and traumas in the community, not just, of course, in the black community, which is trying to make sense of why these two men were so brutally attacked, but also in the white community, very close-knit farming community, who are suddenly forced to defend what happened there, and to defend their furious, violent reaction. And that splits them apart in extraordinary ways too. And then you have this trial at which all these tensions are revealed, and these extraordinary flaws and failures of South Africa's modern institutions simply sort of collapse or come to the fore in the most shocking ways, in ways that I never really expected when I first sort of took a chance, if you like, on this story in January, February 2016, when I thought, hang on, this is potentially the makings of a book.
It absolutely is, and it's going to be more than that. Documentary, feature films, it is just so illuminating. And what's excellent about your book is that you don't try to deliberately draw links for the reader in terms of what does it mean. You don't try to step back from the minutiae. You keep with the characters, with the community, and it reads like a work of fiction, other than the fact that it's all too darn real. And I think that achievement from a writing point of view is absolutely special. So let's honor that by staying with that. Some of the characters are really interesting, and we could take random examples. The book is not reductive as a black-white story, even though you've said black farm workers, white farmers that go on trial, four of these men in the dock. There are other elements of South African life that are illuminated, like, for example, the experiences in the community of an Indian magistrate. Introduce her to the viewers.
So this is Leshni Pillay, and she was one of the reasons that I very quickly thought, hang on, this really could be a story, because she was not only very frank with me in the sort of sessions between court when we spoke, and she would compare what was going on, the pressure she felt she was under as a magistrate to convict quickly, or at least to deny bail to some of these white farmers. She was comparing it to Zimbabwe. She was furious that she felt her career was being threatened. And in fact, she was pushed out of the judiciary, essentially, because of this case. But her frankness about what it was like to arrive in Paris, in this Afrikaans town, as a very young, in her late 20s, magistrate, and to meet the kind of hostility, the racial hostility, and then to overcome it, and then for this case, again, as inevitably a murder case probably must, to pull at those tensions again. It was fascinating.
And because it's a small town, you can't escape the glare of the public at your local spa.
You can't, and yet what struck me so much about Paris and Tumahole, the township, is that they are just two different worlds. So for instance, although I talked on the local community radio station in Tumahole and I talked on the community station in Paris, the only journalists who are actually attending the trial mostly were from the Paris Gazette, which isn't on sale. It's not distributed to Tumahole. So whenever I went there, I talked to people there, there was this absolute thirst for knowledge about what was going on, but nobody knew. No one had a clue the whole way through, even once the trial ended, because it wasn't picked up by any local media there. I think that underscores the kind of divisions that still exist.
That's an interesting division in terms of spatial apartheid geography and how that manifests in still racialized experiences in relation to the media and the justice system. But you've been rightly praised by many professional reviewers and ordinary readers alike for telling a story that illuminates the racial dynamics in Paris, but it doesn't reduce the characters to their racial essences. And I think you do that well, because there are also questions of, and I want you to speak into this next part, language politics and also class dynamics, which in South Africa we don't always lift to the surface because the race stuff is so predominant.
So for instance, within the white farming community, some of the farm managers feel that they are very much inferior to the young sons, these sort of educated young sons of the sort of aristocracy, of white farming aristocracy. And one of those, Fani, ended up being really one of the only accused who actually opened up to me and spoke. Yes, so I mean, it isn't just a black-white thing, clearly. And I suppose what I wanted to do, and you touched on this, as a journalist, but also as a consumer of literature and films and whatever, I don't like my opinions being force-fed to me. I don't like to be told how to feel. And so what I tried to do with this book, and it's a very difficult one because there's so much horrific aggression and racism and violence within it, but I wanted the reader to kind of come to their own conclusions about that, and I wanted to humanize, and Mo was talking about complexity earlier, and I wanted to make these people, even the people who you might want to scream at for what they did, I wanted to show them as complex people with their own real traumas, if you like, about their own experiences on the farms.
Well, I'm going to come back to that, because that's exactly the last question that I planned to ask you. Before we get there, you've already mentioned something which I also plan to explore. South African institutions are on trial. You know, it breaks my heart. One of the reasons this trial couldn't be wrapped up efficiently is in part because our criminal justice system, in terms of the value chain, lets all of us down as South Africans. Tell us a little bit about the coroner, the mixing up of the bodies and the identities of the two black men, and the state of forensic pathology.
So it was very useful for the defense that throughout the trial, the prosecution made no attempt to establish exactly who did what to which of these two confused black bodies. No one tried to differentiate who was Samuel Chika and who was Simon Jubeba. I knew, I was obsessed about it, and I had a very clear understanding from early on about who was whom. But even at the end, the judge, right at the end, called the mother of one, this is 3 years into the case, to try and understand, well, hang on, which one was that one? And this permeated not just the defense, who obviously stood to gain from any confusion, but the prosecution as well. The doctor misdiagnosed both men at the local clinic, almost certainly. The autopsy, as you say, appallingly, inexpertly done, huge holes in it, huge confusion about who these two men were. Were they even the right bodies that were inspected and analyzed? And even the defense's great expert, even he fell into the trap, a man with endless pages on his CV, couldn't actually work out who was whom. They all fell into this trap, I mean, highly racialized, racially charged trap of not caring who was Simon and who was Samuel.
Yeah, that was...
And that to me spoke to the institutions as well, as
yeah,
you
I
say,
think that's
that
important
was an institutional
because
thing.
What that speaks to, as you rightly say, is that we love narrative in South Africa, and narratives that center around experientially questions of identity, racialized, class, linguistic, geographic. But what comes out in this work is the damage to the justice project that is done as a result of technical ineptness within the state.
And I can understand why these things take a long time, or I've learned to understand that South African justice moves slowly, and the Zuma case is what we all know. But I mean, it is astonishing to me that 2 years after the trial ended, more than 2 years, the judge, who was supposed to give her full verdict, a full judgment, written judgment, within 3 months, she still hasn't done that. So you have Ruth Kokota, mother of Samuel Chicha, sitting, waiting in a shack, hoping that she can get some sort of clarity on what happened and on the punishment for those who were accused, and be able to perhaps take her own legal steps to find a way to kind of move on financially and so on. But everyone in this case is still on hold, unable to resume their lives.
We're going to run out of time. I'm going to be greedy. 1 minute each for each of these questions very quickly, because all of them fascinate me. Third last question. How did you get people to talk to you and open up?
Time. There's no special skill. I had the time, the luxury of taking a chunk of time off from my BBC job. I hung around. At first, I was worried, particularly the Afrikaners, close-knit farming community. Here's this Englishman. Why on earth would we talk to him? A lot of them didn't, but a lot of them did. And I think there was an almost a therapeutic role, seeing me there, an outsider. That's what I do as a journalist anyway. That's what we do as a profession. The foreign correspondent comes in. I think it's an incredibly important role, absolutely, whoever's doing it. Yeah. And I'm always sticking up for the role of the foreign correspondent and the idea of it, wherever it be.
Penultimate question. It is also a story of how families are ripped apart. The Van der Westhuizen, for example, couldn't decide whether or not to take plea bargains. So speak to me about how familial fissures were exposed.
The first reaction of a lot of the farmers and their advisors, legal advisors, was say nothing. Look, we caught these guys, we gave them a good kicking, end of story. We were in the right, these two guys died, that's not our fault. But over time, as it became clear that the Hawks, under political pressure, because this was one of those unusual, if you like, farm murders that goes against the grain, white on black. Huge political pressure to break this case, huge pressure on these families, and suddenly technological breakthroughs, I don't want to spoil it because a lot of people haven't followed the case, big technological breakthroughs produce evidence that splits the families apart, some being forced to carry the can, if you like, and others perhaps equally as guilty, perhaps more guilty, walk away.
Last question, we'll explore it in full on another occasion because it's too big for 1 minute, but touch on it. You don't like being told what to think, and therefore you wrote the book brilliantly, and you've been praised by many reviewers for this, in such a manner that you don't take judgment. But we live in a country where we like people to take judgment, some of us. How do you feel about that? Do you like the fact that many people recognize that you suspended moral judgment? Because some people would say, but why isn't Andrew also inscribing moralism into the text?
I'm just thinking of an interview I did with Sizwe and Pofu Walsh, who said, I wanted you to stand on a chair and go, this is a horrific racial murder, which I get. But I personally don't like that kind of journalism and that kind of literature, if I can claim it as that. I want to find that out, at least to an extent myself, although I think it's clear from, I hope everyone in the book, every character in the book, feels that to some extent I've told their truth, but I hope that a reader will be able to form their own conclusions, and I think it's pretty clear.
Absolutely. I hope the BBC gives you time off for more writing, because your writing is so important besides being brilliant. Thank you so much for sharing it with us. Go get a copy of this book. It is absolutely amazing.
This month, Exclusive Books recommends Unbecoming by Joanne Fedler, a funny, heartbreaking homage to the midlife unraveling of a group of women who share their experiences of growing older with aplomb. Set in Tuscany, 1944, Still Life by Sarah Winman is a sweeping portrait of unforgettable individuals who come together to make a family. While Robert by Robert Hamblin manages to challenge every South African to examine not just their own sexuality and identity, but their very humanity. In Women Evolve, Sarah Jakes Roberts draws on scripture to reimagine the story of Eve, encouraging women to reflect on past mistakes to overcome current challenges. And Yellow Means Stay, edited by Orwell Uwazurike, Confidence Uwazurike, and Munachim Ama, is a collection of enthralling, sad, humorous, and heart-touching love stories from across Africa and the Black diaspora. These outstanding books are available at your exclusive bookstore or at exclusivebooks.com.
That's it for today's edition of the show. And of course, you can find out about other books that Exclusive also sell. If you don't yet want to leave your home, just go to exclusivebooks.co.za and check out as well the YouTube channel of Exclusive Books, where all the interviews we've done over the last couple of months can be found. Happy reading.